and the events of the last few weeks, and in terms of Rabbi Kelman's words about mourning for the present, to focus on Nevuah would perhaps not seem to be the most obvious, or perhaps not even the most wise of topics. This is all the more so because there really isn't a natural fit between, I think, the loss and recovery of Nevuah and Tisha B'Av itself. After all, in Megillat Eicha, there is mention of the loss of Nevuah. It's in Perek Bet Pasuk Tet. That is, of course, the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash. But we know that Nevuah returned, at least for some years, for some time after that. So it wasn't, in other words, a complete loss. And when we think of the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash, there again, there's really no natural fit between the loss of Nevuah and those tragic events of the year 70 in the Common Era. After all, Nevuah, by our own very tradition, had been lost centuries before that. So again, there's no natural or obvious connection. And yet, nevertheless, you look at the kinot, and there's mention made in the various kinot of, in fact, just that. That somehow we are mourning the loss of Nevuah as well. And more importantly, I think, there is a sense, both, I would say, stated and unstated, that somehow when we think about the reversal of Tisha B'Av, when we think about the day that will come when we won't have to mourn on this day, but rather that we can finally use this day as a day of celebration, that somehow that day will also bring with it a return of Nevuah. And in that sense, I think Nevuah does somehow and should somehow be part of what we focus and think about today. The first text I want to turn to, I did not photocopy all the text. Most of the text I will simply present to you. I don't know how you're hearing me. It's not clear? Should I give them a chance to... He'll play with it, okay. It would be appropriate to begin then with some words of the Rambam, since my topic is the Rambam, specifically on the loss and recovery of Nevuah, to focus on something that the Rambam says, in fact, about the destruction of the temple. And I think this, in and of itself, I think frames very much not only the Rambam himself as a thinker, but perhaps one of the ways we should begin thinking about the events of this day. It is in a letter on astrology that the Rambam gets around to talking about the destruction of the temple. The letter, for those of you who are not familiar, is a letter that decries, aggressively attacks, if you will, the very belief in astrology, in the very belief in the idea that somehow the way in which the stars are aligned somehow affects our actions, who we are, etc., etc. And his lead-up into this discussion, he begins by saying, look, it is proper for man to accept as true only one of three things, or things that fall into one of three categories. The first is clear proof deriving from man's reasoning. The second one is what man perceives through his or her senses. And the third, that which one receives, again, men and women, Jews, of course, he's speaking about here, receives from the prophets or from the righteous. In other words, reason, our sense perception, and tradition are our sources of knowledge. The Rambam then turns and goes on and speaks about the fact that our foolishness, the very state in which we find humanity in, is precisely because we deviate from these three sources of knowledge. And he very specifically and interestingly points out that, yes, he knows that there are a great many books written and a great many books even coming out, and as we know today, even a greater number of books in circulation. And yet the problem is that we don't always discern what we are reading. In fact, we have this terrible habit of believing what we read, of not reading critically. And he points out in a lovely aside here, I'll actually quote him here. He says, the great sickness and the grievous evil consist in this, that all things that man find written in books, he presumes to think of as true. And all the more so if the books are old. He then goes on from this passage, without missing a beat, and says as follows. Again, I quote, this is why our kingdom was lost and our temple was destroyed, and why we were brought to this very state that we're in now. For our fathers sinned and are no more, because they found many books dealing with these themes of the stargazers. Again, he's speaking here of astrology in particular. These things being the root of idolatry, as we have made clear in the laws concerning idolatry. He's referring to Hilchot
of the Kohavim in the Mishnah Torah. They erred and were drawn after them, imagining them to be glorious science and to be of great utility. They did not busy themselves with the art of war or with the conquest of lands, but imagined that those studies would help them. In other words, what Rambam is saying here in clear, I think in no uncertain terms, is that if you spend your time focusing on that which is foolish, if you spend your time focusing on that which is worthless, well, you will suffer the consequence. And in fact, he's saying here, we did suffer the consequence. We would have been much better off, he is saying here. I don't know if he's making a specific political statement about the last days of Bayit Sheni, but he says we would have been better off, again, by busying ourselves with the art of war and with the conquest of lands, etc. Turning now, I think, again, this should give us pause to think about the Rambam both as an individual who tended to turn away from supernatural explanations and supernatural causality to something far more natural, something far more within our hands and within our own temporal existence. From that I turn to the subject of Nevuah and the Yud Gimel Ikarim. In the text that was passed out here, it's actually at the end of the pile. It's actually appears in Hebrew, and what I've copied here is the Yesod HaShishi, the HaShvi'i, the sixth and seventh principles of faith, which have to do with prophecy. The sixth principle is prophecy in general, and the seventh one is Nevuat Moshe, the prophecy of Moshe in particular. We really will not deal here with Nevuat Moshe, which is a special case and a very interesting one, but one which would take many more hours than I think we have available to us today. When one looks at the sixth Ikar here, Hayesod Hashishi, and I can perhaps read it through in Hebrew, then I have an English translation and I can read it as well, I want to note three different things. Let me just read the first, this Yesod. Hanevuah, Vehu, Sheyeda Adam, Sheze Min Ha'adam Yimatze Bahem Ba'alei Tva'im, Mimidot Me'ulot, excuse me, Vezachot Me'od, Ushlemot Me'od, Gdola, Venafshotehen Nechonot Ad Shehen Mekablot Tzurat HaSechel, Achareichen, flip over and turn it over, Yidbak Oto HaSechel Henoshi, בסכל הפועל, ונאצל ממנו עליו אצילות נכבדה, ואלה הם הנביאים, וזוהי הנבואה, וזהו עניינה. וביאור יסוד זה על בוריו יארך מאוד, ואין כוונתנו להביא מופת על כל יסוד מהם, וביאור מציאות השגתה, לפי שזהו כלל החוכמות כולן. אבל אסקרם דרך סיפור בלבד, ומקראי התורה מעידים על נבואת נביאים הרבה. For the English, one should know among men are found certain people so gifted and perfected that they can receive pure intellectual form. Their human intellect clings to the active intellect, whither it is gloriously raised. These men are the prophets. This is what prophecy is. He adds, a full explanation of this root principle would require much more time, and I'll leave out the last few sentences. There are really three interesting features, I think, even in this one Yesod as laid out here. This appears, by the way, some of you know this, in his introduction to the Mishnah, to Perek Chelek in particular. First, now, in these Yod Gimel Midot, of course, we have everything from God's existence right through to the Yesod, the principle of the resurrection of the dead, Tchiyat HaMeitim. And yet, in all of them, clearly subjects that require great and deep thought, Maimonides doesn't pause and say a full explanation of the root principle would require much more time. And in fact, if you look at the Yesod HaShvi'i, which we won't do together now, even there, he speaks about it, about sort of having to explicate this mystery. He says that, look, to explain the subject fully would take a great, would require a great many preparatory comments, etc., etc. In other words, point number one is that somehow when it comes to this Yesod of Nevuah, the Rambam is somehow signaling us that this takes a great deal more discussion, as if the existence of God or the resurrection of the dead don't. Well, nevertheless, he seems to plant these lines here. Point number two in this section is that, and you heard this, I hope, this is originally written in Arabic, but you hear both from the Hebrew and from the English, that the language is actually philosophical language. The Rambam has chosen some philosophical language to explain the phenomena of nevuah, where, to be quite honest with you, there's something I think that would be a little bit more natural and obvious. He could use the lashon of the Nevi'im themselves to explain the phenomena of nevuah. He doesn't. And the third interesting feature is that as you go through this Yesod HaShishi, again, prophecy in general, and you go through it again, you go through it in any language that you would like to go through it, there's no mention of God. There's no mention of God. This is all written very much from the human perspective. That's why it talks about intellectual form, intellectual attainment. Now, putting aside this, now we can turn to the main source here, which is at the beginning of the sheets, the handout. It's a number of chapters that I've copied from the Rambam's Moreh Nevuchim, the Guide of the Perplexed, in particular here chapter 32 and chapter 36. This is presented here in English. Rabbi Kelman was absolutely right in suggesting that if the original is in Arabic, whether we read it in Hebrew, even with the Ibn Tibbon translation, or we read it in English, in some ways we're equally deficient if we cannot access it in the original language. So let's, due to the difficulty of this, I think English is certainly a wise choice. Now this is one of the things that the Rambam said in the seventh Yesod, back there in one of his earlier writings, in his introduction to the Mishnah, is that he will have occasion to discuss this later in the Book of Prophecy or some other of his writings. And it would seem that the Moreh Nevuchim was finally when he got around to fulfilling his promise and discussing the phenomena of Nevuah. And he does it here. It begins here in chapter 32 of part 2 of the Guide. What he does here, and here I think we have to read carefully and together, I will refer to the page numbering of the page numbers that you have before you. Chapter 32 begins on page 360. What he lays out are three different opinions as to what Nevuah is. And you'll see the first opinion on the bottom of page 360, and please, as always, pay attention to his wording here. The first opinion, that of the multitude of those among the pagans who considered prophecy as true. Now, there's not all pagans, not all idolaters considered prophecy as true, but certainly there were those who did. And also believed by some of the common people professing our law, and he means the Torah, which is to say, he's saying that the view of some people who believe in Avodah Zarah, as well as some Jews, is that God, may he be exalted, chooses from whom he wishes among men and turns him, them, into a prophet, and sends him with a mission. According to them, it makes no difference whether this individual is a man of knowledge or ignorant, aged or young. However, they also posit as a condition of his having a certain goodness and sound morality. So in other words, the first view presented here is a view of God choosing whomever God wants. The one precondition would seemingly be individuals of some basic goodness and sound morality. Clearly, what this opinion is stating is that, again, it says it explicitly, it does not matter whether this individual is a man of knowledge or a man of ignorance. So that seems to be irrelevant. Now, you can tell by the fact that he lumps together Jews with some pagans that this will clearly not be the view that he himself will embrace. We move on to the second opinion, and that is that of the philosophers. Now, one would rightfully say, well, hold on, philosophers didn't generally, certainly the classical Greek philosophers didn't believe in Nevuah. That is correct. Really, what the Rambam is saying here is, for those who accept a philosophical, and work through a philosophical point of view, effectively these are his Muslim Arabic contemporaries, those that preceded him, like Al-Farabi, importantly, but all the way up to Averroes. It is really that. It is the Muslim philosophical perspective that he is articulating here. So the second opinion is that of the philosophers. It affirms that prophecy is a certain perfection in the nature of man. This perfection is not achieved in any individual from among men except after a training that makes that which exists in the potentiality of the species pass into actuality, provided an obstacle due to temperament or to some external cause does not hinder this. Again, very dense language, skip down about 9 lines. We'll come back to this. Where he says, when, in the case of a superior individual who is perfect with respect to his rational and moral qualities, his imaginative faculty is in its most perfect state, and when he has been prepared in the way that you will hear, he will necessarily become a prophet, inasmuch as this is a perfection that belongs to us by nature. Okay? Again, this is a philosophical view. Clearly, the premium here is on training, is on the qualities that an individual can attain. Number one, rational. Number two, moral. And number three, this concept of this imaginative faculty, which we will have occasion to speak about as well. When an individual has all of these qualifications, A, B, and C, then he will again, his words I think are very important here, necessarily become a prophet, inasmuch as this is a perfection that belongs to us by nature. Now, it is this language of necessity, the language of belonging to us by nature, which should help us explain now that first line that I read above, which may have seemed a little obscure, when he says it's the third line in that paragraph, and he says that, being with the second line, this perfection is not achieved in any individual from among men except after a training that that makes that which exists in the potentiality of the species, which is to say, we have a natural potentiality, and it is part of us as who we are, when that potentiality passes into actuality. Okay? This, again, the two statements fit together. And he does add this very important rider, which you will appreciate more in a few moments. It says, provided an obstacle due to temperament or to some external cause does not hinder this. And again, one of the things you will note as you read through this whole paragraph, we've just read a couple of lines here, is that in this philosophical view of prophecy, really the view that views prophecy as basically wisdom, if I may add another word to this, again, it comes from somebody who is rationally, who's perfected his reason, his morals, and his imaginative faculty, all of this coming very much, and he will stress this as he goes on in this discussion, all of this which comes very much from human potential. If you've done all this, you are a prophet. But again, note the point I really want to make here is that you read through this entire paragraph, there's once again no mention of God. This would maybe make perfect sense, right? This is a philosophical view of what Nevuah is. But God doesn't appear here. Again, God, one might suggest, certainly might be the object of the Nevuah, might be the end, the goal, that which is being strived for, but still God is in no way active here in what this is. And he then turns to the third opinion. The third opinion, he goes on to say, is the opinion of our law, the opinion of the Torah, and the foundation of our doctrine. It is identical with the philosophic opinion, except in one thing. That's already a statement. To say that it's identical with the philosophic opinion, please do not take that statement lightly. But there is one exception. Now let us focus on the exception. For we believe that it may happen that one who is fit for prophecy and prepared for it, again, remember that this was really the criteria, a matter of fitness and training, again, that one who is fit for prophecy and prepared for it should not become a prophet, namely, on account of the divine will. In other words, the major, and this is in chapter headings, really, the explanation of this third opinion, which again, it says is the opinion of the Torah itself, that one is prepared, one seemingly, you know, should have all the, one should have access to Nevuah, one should be a Navi, a prophet, but somehow, despite all this preparation, he is not. Why? On account of the divine will. He goes on to add that to my mind, this is like all the miracles and takes the same course as they. Now, one of the things we will not have an opportunity to really discuss here together is to fully understand that when Rambam, what the Rambam means when the Rambam speaks about divine will and what the Rambam means when the Rambam speaks about miracles, about Nisim. Suffice it to say, there is much to say, it's a big subject of conversation. And again, you might rely on my good judgment or not rely on my good judgment. It is far more complicated than what he would seem to suggest here. But there's actually a much bigger problem that's going to face us in a moment. Let me just read the next sentence. For it is a natural thing that everyone who, according to his natural disposition, is fit for prophecy, and who has been trained in his education and study, should become a prophet. Now, he certainly is reiterating the notion that prophecy is something that is natural, that would somehow be something naturally accessible, not to all of us, clearly, but, again, to the individual who actualizes his or her potential, which is to say, reason, morality, and this imaginative faculty. The real trick in reading this, and again, we did not read the introduction to the guide, as perhaps we should have, where the Rambam warns all his readers, saying that there are many things he cannot come right out and say, primarily because perhaps not everything should be said in public. Nevertheless, you see that through the introduction, the Rambam grapples with this very problem. It is clear that he is writing a book because he wants people to think critically, and to sort of appreciate the wisdom behind the Torah, or the wisdom deeply embedded in the Torah. And yet he appreciates that, well, something should be said, something perhaps should be hinted at, whatever that may be. This ends up being one of the classical occasions for us to pause and say, what has the Rambam just done here? Again, he gives us three views. The first view would seem to say, it doesn't matter whether you are wise or not. It doesn't matter whether you've attained and trained yourself or not. God can simply choose you out of the crowd, and that's it. You are now the Navi delivering God's message. The second view, again, rigorously philosophical, no mention of God. It is all about training. And the third view is saying, well, it's like the second view, except that God could step in and prevent it. Now, again, we could ask ourselves, this is a theoretical question, why God would necessarily want to step in and prevent it. Seemingly, one would be only happy to have a world full of Nevi'im. Halavai, we should all be at that level or even attaining that level. I think, you know, given the state of the Jewish world, we'd be thrilled if we had even a handful of Nevi'im. But why God would want to prevent this is certainly a good question. But the real problem with what the Rambam has here laid out is that if you think about this third opinion, that God simply, that the only difference between the third opinion and the second opinion is that in the third opinion, God comes to prevent prophecy, guess what? What has Rambam just said about the one who is a prophet? What has the Rambam said about Yirmiyahu, Yeshayahu, Malachi? You can choose your favorite Navi. Of course, Abraham would sit here, etc., etc. When you actually do attain prophecy, how do you explain what you've just attained? How does the Rambam explain what has just happened? And it is very clear from what he's done here. He has stated, I think really very, very clearly, if you only know how to read this, that in fact, when you do attain Nevuah, when you do attain prophecy, in fact, the explanation is found in the second opinion. Again, the third opinion is simply telling you when you don't become a Navi. That's very nice and that's very interesting. I'm telling you it's also very problematic because it ends up that what the Rambam means by divine will and what he does with miracles is very problematic. But set all that aside, for understanding when you actually do attain Nevuah, what has happened? How do we understand that? There's no way to understand this except by reverting back to the second opinion, which he has stated. He says, our view is identical with the philosophic opinion, except in one thing. What he has done is he's thrown a perfect curveball. Each and every one of us reads this and looks at the except in one thing. We all follow the ball, and the ball is the exception. That's all beautiful and fine and dandy. But I'm not interested in the exception. We shouldn't be. We should be interested in what is Nevuah. And again, Nevuah would seem to be something that he has said here in the second opinion. Now, the qualification here that would seem to be perhaps least accessible to us would be the one of the imaginative faculty. Again, it seems fairly clear in the Rambam's writings that when he speaks about a perfected reason, and he said this enough times that I think we can be fairly secure in repeating it, he speaks about somebody who has mastered all of physics and all of metaphysics. The physical sciences, the metaphysical sciences. Clearly this is not a small deal, but it is something that he certainly believed was within human, you know, within reach of us humans. To speak about the perfection of the moral faculties, again, certainly here the Rambam very quickly and easily would point to the life of mitzvot that create the morally perfect individual. But what is this imaginative faculty? So for that, you have to turn to page 369, which is the second of the chapters I've copied here. And it is that chapter that is devoted to this. Okay? Now here in chapter 36, this is always one of the great problems in the Rambam. You'll notice that his language starts shifting a little. So I begin at the beginning of 36. Know that the true reality and quiddity, which is to say the essence of prophecy, consists in its being an overflowing from God, may he be cherished and honored, through the intermediation of the active intellect, this is again a classical philosophical term, toward the rational faculty in the first place, and thereafter toward the imaginative faculty. Suddenly, here at least, the Rambam would seem to certainly insist that somehow this comes from God. This is, uses the language of an overflowing from God. As a very important note, though, here, in appreciating this, the Rambam, of course, uses the exact same kind of wording when he speaks about the creation of the physical world, which is to say that the very physical world, including all the laws of nature, including the laws of nature that the Rambam insists are there for all time, also come as an overflowing from God. In other words, the real question, or one of the questions that one needs to ask here, is when, again, he's describing this phenomenon of nevuah, of prophecy, we normally would assume that a nevuah comes to an individual, whether it be Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, or whoever it may be. When the Rambam here speaks in terms of the language of an overflowing from God, it may be, in fact, that what he's saying is that, well, what overflows from God? Obviously, the essence of God, that being God's wisdom, overflows into the world. In fact, it ends up that that's how the physical world is sustained, precisely in that overflow from God. If so, then nevuah, again, is not necessarily in any way here to be understood as somehow an individual overflowing from God to an individual Navi out there. Rather, it might be something far more generalized being described here. That's really point number one. Point number two, though, is to return to what we said before, which is that Rambam speaks about the rational faculty in the first place, and thereafter toward the imaginative faculty. So once again, we ask, what is this imaginative faculty? And he goes on and explains this essentially on page 370, 371, and all the way to 373. Now, he says a number of things. He repeats a number of times that the imaginative faculty is a bodily faculty. It is something, again, that we have as something physically innate within us. On top of page 370, you will see on that first paragraph there, Rambam says, you know too, the actions of the imaginative faculty that are in its nature, such as retaining things perceived by the senses, combining these things, and imitating them. Interesting. Later on, he will have the following line. This is actually right in the middle of page 370 of that paragraph there. Similarly, the action of the imaginative faculty in the state of sleep is also its action in the state of prophecy. So he's starting to do something here. Again, admittedly, because of our time constraints, I'm cutting a few corners. But the Rambam does a few things here. Number one, he says the imaginative faculty is very much what we mean when we say or think of our dream state. What happens in our dreams, in fact, is just that. It's the imaginative faculty that is functioning, albeit at a very, very low level, this has to be stressed. But it is the imaginative faculty. Why? Again, it is the faculty, I'm going back to that first line on top of 370, the first line of that paragraph, retaining things perceived by the senses, combining these things, and imitating them. And as he goes on to say, that is exactly what we do in our dreams, of course. In our dreams, we're not really seeing whatever it is that we are seeing. We close our eyes and we imagine things. And it's precisely because we are closing our eyes and simply retaining various images from whatever we saw or experienced that day or other days or earlier in our life, that we also combine these things. We combine images and we imitate them. When he says combining images, again, he's very much thinking, and he does state this, he's thinking of what takes place in our dreams. After all, our dreams are different than our waking reality in what? In that our dreams, cause and effect, go out the window. Sequence goes out the window. There's no chronology. In our dreams, things happen backwards. In our dreams, things take place which we know to be absurd. You even have that sense in your dreams that this is absurd, and nevertheless, it is exactly what a dream state is. What then is the difference between dream state and prophecy, or how do these connect? Well, what the Rambam goes on to explain is, he does this again at length over page 370 and 371. First of all, you need to know that one of the things that the Rambam insists on is that all nevuah, and this is a crucial point, all nevuah takes place either through a dream or through a vision, but what he means a vision is what we might call a daydream. Nevuah does not take place in any kind of conscious state, the conscious state that I hope most of us are in now, does not take place with the exception of Moshe. Nevuat Moshe is the great exception, again, and that we cannot deal with here. But to say that all dreams, all nevuah, excuse me, take place either through a night vision or a day vision, night dreaming or daydreaming, is of course, once again, to tie this idea of the imaginative faculty into nevuah as directly as he could. And he means it. What he is suggesting is that the difference between our dreams, if you will, and between that of a Navi, is really one simply of quality. It's the same thing. It's all about imagining. It's all about vision. The question is, what's a Navi, who, as you will call again before, somebody who already has a perfected rational intellect, would seem to dream about different things than we dream about? And the Rambam basically makes the point, I think straightforward but very important point, that what one spends one's waking time with is of course ultimately going to overflow into one's dream time. Which is to say that if one would suppose, and there's a phrase like this I think somewhere in the Gemara, that chickens of course dream about chicken feed. And cows dream about whatever it is that cows eat, but hay and other things, etc., etc. We humans, of course, are very complex animals. And many of us spend our waking time chasing and worrying about and thinking about and desiring all kinds of things. Things that perhaps we really shouldn't be spending our time thinking about, desiring, etc., etc. But clearly one who is passionately, deeply, deeply devoted to the study of physics and metaphysics. And remember that those being really the subject matter, if you will, of the perfection of the rational intellect. One who spends time pursuing that kind of wisdom is exactly the kind of individual who, again, comes back to those subjects over and over again, thinks about them, turns them over in his mind day by day, week by week, month by month, year by year, is exactly the kind of individual whose dreams too will be affected by exactly this pursuit for wisdom, for knowledge, both in physics and in metaphysics. That is exactly what he seems to go on and describe here. You'll see that, for example, on paragraph 371. It's rather lengthy, but that is the point that he makes there. So, again, we should ask ourselves, then what is this imaginative faculty, which seems to be the crucial, or a crucial ingredient to the life of prophecy? Well, again, if we think of the Nevi'im, broadly speaking, what did they do? Clearly what they were doing was bringing the Word of God to Am Yisrael. In this sense, to use a much more modern phrase, Nevi'im were, at some basic level, great communicators. We know this, we know from their literature, we know from the way in which their Nevuah is recorded, that indeed, they have fantastic images, but more than that, of course, what they see is a sense of where Am Yisrael has been, where Am Yisrael is, where Am Yisrael is going. There are individuals who have a deep sense as to what we've accomplished, but of course, more importantly, given where the Nevi'im go, they have a very deep and abiding sense of where we failed individually, where we failed socially, where we have failed politically, militarily even, etc. What the Nevi'im are, in other words, were great communicators. And what the Rambam is suggesting is that there is, in fact, a link. In other words, why is this imaginative faculty so important and so crucial for Nevuah? It is because it takes a certain kind of individual that sees through the dross, that sees through our daily life with all its inertia and all its distractions, etc., etc., who appreciates that if we continue in the following way, we as a community, we as Am Yisrael, that we are heading for disaster. Or, you know, that of course tends to be a major message among the Nevi'im. But even short of that, they are constantly the ones who are prodding us to appreciate what we are truly doing. Which is another way of saying that they conceive of reality with a certain clarity in a way that we don't. And again, therein for the Rambam, I think, lies the really crucial aspect of Nevuah. It is why the imaginative faculty, in fact, is a crucial ingredient of what is going on. It's not just all about reason, although again, remember that is a fundamental criteria here. And it's not all just about being a morally perfect individual, although unquestionably that too is a criteria here. But there's something more. In another place, the Rambam in fact labels the individual. What do you call one who is perfected in their reason but has absolutely no imaginative faculty? Just simply doesn't have a capacity to think that way. And effectively, he says, that's a scientist. That's a scientist, and that's very important. But there's a difference, we would say, between a scientist and a Navi. So it seems that this imaginative faculty now is crucial in that respect. Now, this focus on the imaginative faculty is also going to be very important, because let us remember, again, when the Rambam introduced this at the beginning of chapter 32, that he said, well, we have the view of the philosophers. Let me even reread that for a moment. A very important line back there on page 361, where he said, provided an obstacle due to temperament or to some external cause does not hinder this. In other words, when speaking of the philosophical view, he said it belongs to us by nature. It comes to us naturally. But even with the philosopher, or the philosophical view of Nevuah, he admits that, of course, there could be obstacles. Obstacles, again, due to temperament or to some external cause. And this is page 361, six or seven lines down. We will, of course, recall that in the third opinion, he speaks of Nevuah and speaks of the Nevi'im who are trained to be Nevi'im, except that something interceded. Now, of course, that something is God. The question is now how we put all this together. And for that, I'd like to turn and read with you on page 372 and over on 373, is the paragraph that begins on the bottom of 372. You know, says the Rambam, that every bodily faculty sometimes grows tired. And I remind you, he's already defined the imaginative faculty as being a bodily faculty. It's something that is physically within us. Again, you know that every bodily faculty sometimes grows tired, is weakened, and is troubled, and at other times is in a healthy state. Now, the imaginative faculty is indubitably a bodily faculty. Accordingly, you will find that the prophecy of the prophets ceases when they are sad or angry, or in a mood similar to one of these two. You know that the saying that prophecy does not descend during a mood of sadness or languor, this is a line from the Gemara, that prophetic revelation did not come to Jacob our father, to Yaakov Avinu, during the time of his mourning, because of the fact that his imaginative faculty was preoccupied with the loss of Yosef. Well, let's just think about this for a moment, what he has just said. We know, again, this is really Chazal's tradition, that from the moment that Yaakov heard or was told that his son had died, that Yosef was taken from him, he never had Nevuah until, of course, the sons come back and they announce, Abba, Abba, Yosef is alive. And of course, there's a lovely Hebrew phrase, Vayipa'em Rucho. That's it. Now, Chazal sees on those two very beautiful words, what do you mean that his spirit sort of rings within him again? Bingo. it's exactly at that moment that Nevuah returned to him. Now, losing a son, of course, is something that, lo aleinu, we don't wish on anyone. But clearly, it is enough to make any parent and put any parent into a depression, deep or otherwise. And it's exactly what the Rambam is describing here. He's saying, if you think about the imaginative faculty, it is a bodily faculty. It sometimes does grow tired. And of course, it also, when you are depressed, you do not function physically. And in a very, again, natural way, he then describes what happened to Yaakov. In other words, the reason that Yaakov ceased to be able to communicate with God was what? Was over the loss of his son. Now, obviously, in the grand scheme of things, we can say, and we should say, that whatever happened with Yosef, with the brothers, was something foreordained. This was something somehow that that God wanted the situation, the story of Yaakov, to play out in a certain way. But again, notice that that's not where the Rambam goes with this. What the Rambam wants to say, and what he is saying here very simply, is that understand that the imaginative faculty sometimes functions and sometimes doesn't, and that those causes are, again, something that are natural. It is natural for a father to mourn the loss of a son, particularly when it is Yaakov mourning the loss of Yosef. Again, understanding the whole background to the story there. So this is, I think, crucial to understanding, again, a number of elements here. It is crucial now, and we perhaps have a little bit of a hint of what the Rambam means when he says, the third view, the view of the Torah, is in fact the view identical to the philosophical one, except that, something, there could be some intervention. That intervention may be divine will, it may be miracles, but at the bottom line, it is something that again works its way through in the most natural of means. And you will recall, as I just pointed out, that even in the second opinion, even the philosophical view acknowledges that due to temperament or due to other causes, one may cease to be a prophet. Now, what does this have to do with us today, here, Tisha B'Av, etc.? I'll continue reading here. So he spoke about Yosef, and then he continues and says, and that prophetic revelation did not come to Moshe. He's giving us other examples, peace be on him, after the disastrous incident of the spies, and until the whole generation of the desert perished, in a way that revelation used to come before. So even Moshe, of course, at some point, went into a certain depression, because seeing the enormity of their crime, he suffered greatly because of this matter. This was so even though the imaginative faculty did not enter his prophecy, as the intellect overflowed toward him without its intermediation. Again, this is a problem we'd have to leave for another time. For as we have mentioned several times, he, meaning Moshe, did not have Nevuah like the other Nevi'im by means of parables. This will be made clear later on, for it is not the purpose of this chapter. Similarly, you will find that several prophets prophesied during a certain time, and that afterwards prophecy was taken from them, and could not be permanent because of an accident that had supervened. This, he goes on, is indubitably the essential and proximate cause of the fact that prophecy was taken away during the time of the exile. And here I think he has said it, and I think brought it for exactly where we sort of need him to go on this day on Tisha B'Av. For what languor or sadness can befall a man in any state that would be stronger than that due to his being a thrall slave in the bondage to the ignorant, who commit great sins, and in whom the privation of true reason is united to the perfection of the lusts of the beasts? That is all a very long, convoluted sentence, but the Rambam is simply saying that, what do you want from a people who are in bondage, who are in galut, to a very ignorant, to ignorant peoples? And there shall be no might in thine hand. This was with what we have been threatened. And this is what it meant by saying, they shall run to and fro and seek the word of the Lord and shall not find it. Pasuk from Amos. And it also says, her king and her princes are among the nations. The law is no more. Ye, her prophets, find no vision from the Lord. This is, of course, from Eicha. This is true, and the cause thereof is clear. For the instrument has ceased to function. this also will be the cause for prophecy being restored to us in its habitual form, as has been promised in the days of the Mashiach, in the days of the Messiah, may He be revealed soon. So now, of course, what the Rambam has said is, pay attention. Because the issue of Nevuah is not only the personal issue of a Yaakov mourning for his son, or a Moshe who's had it with his people, and that these become tremendous distractions that stand in the way, that really reverse the process of Nevuah. What the Rambam is saying is that this in some ways is exactly what has happened writ large in our society, in our community as a whole. In other words, we live in Galut, he's writing for the situation of Galut, we live under other people's rules, we suffer, and clearly all of that, both being again under the rule of the ignorant, we will have occasion just for a couple more moments to touch on that, and with all the suffering, it is clear that the imaginative faculty would not function. It is clear, to put it in other words, that in the state of Galut, we don't have that sense of vision. We don't have that sense of clarity of understanding what is taking place around us. Now, to bring this home, I think one needs to really reflect on really one final little bit here, which is to think about what the Rambam says about Yemot HaMashiach, and how that, I think, does very neatly pull this notion of Nevuah in. As again, I think some of you would know, the Rambam states both very, very early on in his writings and repeats it in the Mishnah Torah, repeats it in fact a number of times, that he insists that there's no difference, of course using a phrase of Chazal, between Yemot HaMashiach and our age, with the exception of Shibud Malchuyos. So I'll read a few sentences. There's no difference between our age and the Messianic age, except for the fact that we will have sovereignty. The question is again, why is this so important and why it's so crucial? Earlier in Chelek, the Rambam writes, so this is the English translation, the days of the Messiah refers to a time in which sovereignty will revert to Israel and the Jewish people will return to the land of Israel. He goes on, excuse me, a few lines later, and says all nations will make peace. So it's not just simply a sense of Jewish sovereignty, it's a sense of actually living in a secure and peaceful environment. And the Rambam reiterates by saying, however, except for the fact that sovereignty will revert to Israel, nothing will be essentially different from what it is now. In other words, the Rambam is simply insisting that when we think of a Messianic age, we're foolish if we think of money growing on trees or, you know, day school education being free or whatever the situation may be. He says that's not exactly what we are about. It simply is a matter of political sovereignty. He also goes on and says, the great benefits which occur in those days include our release from oppression by other kingdoms, which prevents us from fulfilling all the commandments, a widespread increase of wisdom. And then again, you begin to see how the Rambam is extending and painting his picture. Essentially, what the Rambam is after is as follows. He thinks and he argues that political sovereignty is crucial not because of any kind of latent nationalism, but rather because what we want more than anything at all, is to have essentially the tranquility, the peace of mind to nurture wisdom. That's what we're missing. And of course, it makes perfect sense given what he said just before about the imaginative faculty and the loss of prophecy, because of course, again, in an era when we've been persecuted, or even I stand here and we know exactly what's going on in Israel, in an era where we are fighting for our existence, fighting to simply keep others at bay, it is impossible to have the tranquility, the peace of mind, to really engender, develop that kind of wisdom. And it's for that reason that the Rambam comes back over and over again and speaks about what it is that we seek in the Messianic age. He writes, and now I'm quoting from the end of the Mishnah Torah. Actually, I can read this in Hebrew and then in English. Lo nitavu hachachamim v'hanevi'im yimot ha-mashiach, lo kedei sheyishletu al kol ha'olam, v'lo kedei sheyirdu b'goyim, v'lo kedei sheyenasu otam ha'amim, v'lo kedei le'echol v'lishtot v'lismoach, אלא כדי שיהיו פנימים בתורה וחוכמתה, ולא יהיה להם נוגס ומבטל, כדי שיזכו לחיי העולם הבא, כמו שבארנו בהלכות תשובה. The sages and prophets did not long for the days of the Messiah, that Israel might exercise dominion over the world, or rule over the heathens, or be exalted by the nations, or that it might eat and drink and rejoice. Their aspiration was that Israel be free to devote itself to the law, to the Torah, and its wisdom, with no one to oppress or disturb it, and thus be worthy of life in the world to come. It's clear, I think, as I stand here, I think we all feel in our own lives, in our own communities, that if we had the chance, if we had the ability to engender this kind of wisdom, which is very much in our hands. Again, I repeat to the theme I tried to develop before, that for the Rambam, Nevuah, and I think he does this may be painful for us to hear, but I think he does this on purpose, Nevuah is not something that we first and foremost have to invoke God on. Again, as you will see, if you go back to the Yesod HaShishi in his 13 principles, if you read through again the section on Nevuah and the Mor Nevuchim, it's clear that he sees this as something in our hands. This is a wisdom that must be developed and inculcated by us. But it is exactly the reason that we must pray, I think pray as much as we can, for peace, of course, both here in Israel and in the world in general.
Okay, we'll take a 4 or 5 minute break, and Rabbi Travers will be next. Yes, Yeshua. Dr. Porter, there's an issue for those who don't know, that we don't need to do introductions on Bishop, but he's coming from...